Welcome to Built to Go, a van life podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Wagg, coming to you from the College of Curiosity. This time it's episode 282, and guess what, folks? It's true. It really is true. I've been wrong all along. Well, I have a little bit. And we're also going to talk about a product review of a strange thing I've never seen in anyone's rig, a tale from the road involving me looking for a rock, and places you can stay in the winter. It's going to be better than how that sounds. but first, some business. I am about to go to Malta. Malta is a country. It's also an island in that country, and I'm going to go visit there as a scouting mission to see if this might be a good place to retire to. But while I'm there, I'm also going to check out the van life scene, which I don't think is terribly huge because it's a very crowded island and you can take your van there. But I think if you're going to go to Malta for van life, you're going to stay at the one campground they have because parking on the street is not going to be pleasant. But because I'm going to Malta, I will probably not be able to do a podcast for every week this month. I haven't figured out how that's going to work out. Just a warning there. That said, let's just get right into the things I've been wrong about that I've encountered. I love being wrong because being wrong is a gift. And by that I mean that the moment you know you're wrong, you have more than you did before. You have more information. You're more right. So every time that you're wrong, you're better off than when you're right, but actually wrong and don't know it, if that makes any sense. So all of these things I'm about to talk about are things that I either was just flat wrong about, or things that I was incomplete about, or things that I think maybe we need to talk about some more. And as always, I invite any of you who catch me saying something wrong or incomplete or not considering something to please get in touch at jeff@builttogo.com. That's two T's, not three, not one. We are all in this together. And the point is to encourage each other to get out there and do the things that people want to do as good as possible. That's some terrible English there, but the sentiment remains. First thing, and I have to thank JR for bringing this to my attention. We never actually got to have a phone call, but I managed to have a little bit of an email conversation with him, and I got his point. JR wrote to me a couple of weeks ago basically saying that my idea about running the 5-volt circuit around my rig doesn't make sense. And I thought, well, why not? I need all these 5-volt outlets in places, why not just run a 5-volt circuit? And then he pointed out some very basic things that I had forgotten for some reason. And the fact that he's an electronics technician made me think that maybe he knows what he's talking about. and it does. And here's the thing. It's something I've talked about on the show. When you lower the voltage, you increase the amperage. That's just how things go. And while 5-volt things generally aren't high amperage, the requirement for the wires changes. If you do a long 5-volt run, you need really thick cables because the loss from voltage loss, which is a thing that happens over long runs of wire, is going to be not only large, it's going to be very consequential. Because with only 5 volts to work with, if you drop down to 4.5 volts, things might start acting funny, and it's not going to take very long to do that. Now, you can go to any truck stop and buy a 10-foot USB cord, for example. But you're never going to see a 75-foot USB cord. And that's partially due to this. So based on JR's comments, I did the math, and it turns out that you're actually better off running a 12-volt circuit with adapters for 5 volts right at the point that you need them. And while this seems very inefficient to my brain because each one of those points is a loss of energy, the energy you're losing there is not consequential to what you're doing, meaning that your voltage to the device is going to stay the same, which is the important part, and you don't have to use as big wires. You're going to generate some heat, of course, and you are going to lose some efficiency. But if you're starting with a 12-volt battery, basically we're talking about like a cigarette lighter plug where you need it with a USB adapter plugged into it. Or what I think I'm going to do is I'm going to hardwire USB outlets that feed into a 12-volt fuse block. it does seem inefficient to my brain, but I understand the wiring, and this actually will make sense in my rig, and it would make even more sense if your rig was larger. If you're in a little tiny, tiny, tiny rig, it maybe doesn't matter so much, but even if you're doing a 20-foot run, that's probably too much for 5 volts. So that's something I was wrong about, and I may have figured out had I actually gotten down to that part of my build yet, which I haven't. So I will keep reporting what I've discovered about this 5-volt circuit idea, but right now, based on JR's comments and my research, the proper way to do it is to run 12 volts and then convert it to 5 as close to the use point as possible. And I've got different thoughts about how exactly to do that, because unfortunately, the thing about this is that technology is changing, and even my Airstream, you know, 2018 Airstream put USB outlets all over it, but they're the old ones that are USB-A, you know, the big rectangular ones, but they're also low amperage. So they're giving off, I think, 1 amp of power at best, and that's just not enough these days. It takes forever to charge your cell phone off of a 1-amp charger, and yeah, it'll power a light or a little fan, but they're kind of obsolete. If I ever want to charge my phone, I have to plug in an adapter right next to the USB outlet, which seems silly. So there's a lot to think about here. I will keep revisiting this topic. Know that it is not a good idea to run a 5-volt circuit from your 12-volt battery. Run the 12-volt circuit and then add 5-volt taps off of that. Another thing I forgot to mention, this wasn't really a mistake, this was an omission, was about heat pumps. The easiest way to think about them is a reversible air conditioner. They can pump heat out or in, basically. It's literally how the technology works. They just reverse, and they do work, and they make sense in some cases, and a lot of air conditioners for RVs now come with them built in. In fact, the newest Zero Breeze, Nelly tells me, has a reversible heat pump in it, so you can actually have the Zero Breeze make heat, but they're not really that good at making heat. As I mentioned earlier, they use a lot of power to do it, and you're almost better off just using a regular old toaster-style heater. But the other thing is that they are only efficient at certain temperatures. So if it goes down to 50 degrees Fahrenheit or, you know, maybe 12, 13 degrees Celsius and you want a little bit of heat, yes, they'll work and they can warm up the room. But if it's below freezing or even close to freezing, they simply won't work. So this would absolutely not be a solution for anybody trying to do winter camping or anything like that. Heat pumps will not work. Now, if you have a heat pump in your home, it's a little bit different, and then there are geothermal heat pumps. We're not talking about that. We're talking about the portable ones that will fit in your vehicle. They will not work if the temperature is too cold. If you're going to stay in Florida and you just want something more convenient than efficient, yeah, okay, it might work. But if you're traveling around the country, Montana in the winter, oh, no. You will not be using your heat pump. It simply won't work. I also failed to mention in the heat episode about the two different kinds of propane heat and how they affect your life in the van. So there's the RV style of propane heater, which is exactly like your one in a home. It's a furnace that burns gas and heats up a tube and air blows through the tube. It exhausts gases outside your rig, and then the hot air comes inside. They make a nice dry heat, and you don't have to worry about any carbon monoxide or anything because that's all going outside the vehicle. They're big, they're expensive, they use a lot of fuel, etc. That's why RV companies use them. They're easy to understand, and they're the most home-like. But when you get into the Mr. Heater Buddies and the Olympian Wave 3s, the catalytic heaters, and this applies to the butane heaters that I didn't even talk about, they work, they're more efficient, but they also pump a lot of moisture into your rig. Whenever you burn something, honestly anything, but especially propane, butane, any flammable gas, you're going to get a lot of moisture, even if you're catalyzing that gas versus burning it, and I talked about that before. The chemical reaction combines hydrogen and oxygen, giving you H2O, which gives off heat, but also produces, you know, water. And that water vapor gets into your rig. So if it's cold out, if it's very cold out, and you're using one of these heaters, and you've managed not to let the fuel get cold enough so it can't off-gas, that moisture is going to condense on any cold surface in your rig, and it's going to turn to water and then possibly ice, and it's a mess. The difference between a rig heated with a traditional RV furnace-style propane heater and a catalytic propane heater in the winter is dramatic. It can be mitigated with ventilation, but of course, ventilation means you're letting out heat. And heat carries moist air, so you actually do want to let it out. So you got to do some math there. If you have a big propane tank on your rig, and you have a big rig, a traditional propane furnace-style heater is almost certainly superior to a catalytic heater. But in a small rig, like a minivan or something where you're going to move this thing around, there's obvious advantages to that. So you just have to weigh what you're trying to do and what makes sense. But do ventilate if you're using a catalytic heater. That cannot be overstated. There are many people who think it's never safe to run one of these indoors. Other people do it all the time. You have to make your own decisions there. But no matter what your decision is, make sure it includes ventilation. That's super important. The next thing I was wrong about, I'm not sure I'm wrong about, but it does deserve more discussion. And this is something I've been doing for years, which is using windshield washer fluid in my cassette toilet and in the traps of my rigs for winterization purposes. To be very, very clear, windshield washer fluid never touches any surface that has fresh water. Ever. It doesn't go in the freshwater tank. It doesn't go in any of the lines. None of that. It is only going in places that I would never drink from, basically. So drains, the toilet. No, I do not drink from the toilet. You'll be happy to know. And it has worked great, but there's a lot more to the conversation than that. First off, not all windshield washer fluid is created equal. You can actually buy windshield washer fluid that says good to 32 degrees Fahrenheit in the States. That's called water. Water is good to 32 degrees Fahrenheit, and you don't want that. I mean, sure, if you live in Key West and it's never going to see freezing temperatures, that stuff's fine. But anywhere you're going where it can freeze, you don't want that anywhere. You don't want it in your car. You don't want it in this weird method I'm using. So make sure you get a washer fluid that has a rating that is well below freezing, and you want it well below freezing. Like, if you're concerned about, well, it might go down into the 20s Fahrenheit or the negative 7 area Celsius this week, I better, you know, add some antifreeze. And, oh, look, this one's good down to 15 degrees Fahrenheit or, you know, negative 10 or whatever Celsius. Don't forget that it's going to get diluted. If you're pouring it down the drain or something, it's going to mix with water. And when it mixes with water, that number is going to go closer to the freezing point. So you want to buy the one that has the lowest temperature as possible, but you will notice that the price is directly related to that. And at some point, you're going to get near the price of just RV antifreeze, the pink stuff, propylene glycol, which is going to be safer and it resists dilution more. So that's always better. The only reason to use washer fluid instead of RV antifreeze is that it's cheaper. That's really all there is to it. So let's talk more a little bit more about this. What is windshield washer fluid? It's water, sometimes a little bit of soap or some other kind of surfactant, and methyl alcohol, wood alcohol. This is the kind of alcohol that if you drink it, you go blind. It's also called denatured alcohol. If you want to read a really horrific bit of history, look up the history of denatured alcohol and how governments decided it was better to poison people than to let them drink alcohol. Ugh. Anyway, but that's the stuff that's in there. You are pouring this stuff in whatever you're doing. That's why it should never touch anything you're ever going to put near your mouth. But alcohol has two properties that are not ideal for this purpose. One is that it evaporates. So in my cassette toilet, this is in an enclosed container. That's how cassette toilets work. You have a tank for the flushing fluid. And you put the windshield washer fluid in there, unless there's some venting in there, which there shouldn't be. It'll be fine. But if you use it to, say, fill your toilet, like you want to add like a cup in the toilet to like cover the seal for the winter, that can evaporate over time. And when you get there in the spring, you might just find a blue stain. And it would probably still have protected what you were trying to protect because it would have pushed the water out. But just know that this stuff evaporates and that can matter. The other thing is this is flammable. The alcohol is flammable, and the better stuff you get, the more flammable it is, because it's just simply going to have more methyl alcohol in it. That could potentially be a problem. If you're using this in some sort of a tank that is not properly vented, those fumes could build up, and if they encounter an ignition source, you could have a fire. It seems very, very unlikely to me, but the potential is there. I've been doing this for years and years and years and years, and I've never had a problem. but I have to point out that there is potential for a problem. Now, the arguments on the internet about this stuff is all over the place, like many things. People are like, oh, no, that stuff's toxic, which it is. You can't let it out into the environment, which is a little bit silly, because when you think about it, and you go to the auto parts store, and you look at all the rows and rows and rows of windshield washer fluid bottles, where does that stuff end up? It goes straight to the environment. All that stuff is being dumped in the environment, every single bottle. It's being put in vehicles, and when people spray their windshields, that stuff goes out in the environment. And you could argue, oh, yeah, but it just evaporates. That's what it's going to do, no matter where you put it. You don't want to dump it in a pond or anything like that. I mean, it will have a localized effect. But, yeah, as long as you're disposing of your gray water and black water responsibly at the end of the season, that is not a huge concern for me. Some people say it dissolves seals and stuff. I've never had that experience. Maybe somebody has. So anyway, I'm just giving you the information. You have to make the decisions. I am fine with using a decent quality windshield washer fluid for making my cassette toilets work in the winter. And also, actually, I use it to flush the toilet in my Airstream in the winter, because it works and I haven't had any problems. So there's the full story. Finally, this is something I'm going to say I was wrong about this, but it's really more just a more information situation. One of the best ways to heat your rig is with a space heater. In the US, you get these 1500 watt space heaters, and other countries have different ones because they have more power coming out, they have more voltage coming out of their sockets, so the wattages might be a little different. But in the US, the 1500 watt space heater is a very easy, cheap thing to get. And if you have power, it's a good way to heat your van because it's very, very dry and very easy to control. But there's a problem, and this is something that I'm just learning that every electrician already knows. Your outlets are rated for a certain amount of amperage, right? So in the US, your normal 110, 120 volt outlet is rated for 15 amps. There are others, but that's a normal rating. In your RV or rig that you built, depending, you have probably put in 15 amp circuits. A 500 watt heater on high is getting pretty close to that 15 amps. It might be doing 13 amps or 14 amps, which is fine, right? You're below that 15, so you're not going to trip the breaker. There's nothing to worry about. But there is, because there is a time factor as well. If you run a space heater on full blast for a long period of time, things are going to start getting warm. And in many RVs specifically, they use the cheapest possible outlets they can get, and they will start to melt. So if you draw 15 amps all at once, you're fine. But if you draw 14.5 amps for 10 hours, it's going to generate enough heat to melt the outlet, but not to trip the breaker. You see the problem here? And then that outlet becomes damaged, and then it can become a fire hazard. So the advice from electricians is, do not run space heaters on high for any long period of time unless they're on a 20 amp circuit. And this is also why you should never use an extension cord with a space heater, because making the cord longer increases the amps. You see the problem. So the new piece of information for me is that there's a time factor in these ratings. And for a space heater specifically, it can exceed the recommended 80% limit on the circuit. So 80% of 15 is 12 amps. And 12 amps is 1,440 watts. 1,500 watts is more than that. Therefore, a 1,500 watt space heater will exceed the recommended rating of 80%. It's a little wonky, but the bottom line is that if you're going to run your space heater on high, you probably should check that, you should make sure the circuit can handle, say, 20 amps. If you're going to run it on low, which I find is often enough, the 500 watt setting, you're fine. You don't have anything to worry about. Also, this applies to hair dryers as well. You're okay running a hair dryer because you're not running it that long. You are exceeding the 80%, but it's not for that long, so it's going to be okay. Nobody runs a hair dryer for hours, I hope. Another little bit of information to worry about there, but it could save your rig from burning down, so it's kind of important. And that's it. Again, if you find anything you think I've been wrong about, please let me know. But I will keep coming clean every so often as I collect these things. And thanks to everyone who's reached out and said, are you sure about that? Because that is super, super helpful. Again, Jeff at built2go.com. That's 2 T's, not 3, not 1. Thank you to a man with a plan. You know who you are because he bought me some gallons at buymeacoffee.com/built2go. And with those gallons, I will support my van life, which will also support the podcast. And I thank you. And there will be no ads on the podcast because he or she did that. And because of everyone who does this every month. Thank you, everyone. No ads. If you would like to help out the show, visit buymeacoffee.com/built2go. And you can buy me a gallon or two or whatever the heck you want to do. And I will thank you, as will everyone else. Van life news. Okay, just one item this week. But it's a big one. It's actually not new news, but it's an article that I think everybody should read just so they understand a point that I have been making over and over again. But, I mean, it's important. And this is the thing that keeps me up at night about van life. So this is from Jalopnik, the website that's been doing reporting on car issues forever. The name of the article is These U.S. States Make Sleeping in Your Car Almost Impossible. And this is from July, so it's not new, but it talks about Florida House Bill 1365, which doesn't prohibit overnight sleeping or camping in public areas. It prevents anyone from allowing it. It prevents any county in the state from allowing overnight sleeping or camping in public areas. Instead of making it outright illegal themselves, they've made it illegal for anyone to say it's legal, which is an interesting legal thing to do. And they set up some exemptions for that if you follow rules. But one of the rules is that they have to have security on site. And there must be restrooms with running water. And there must be access to mental health services. Again, with all of these things, they're not coming after us, van life folk in general, specifically. They're going after homeless folks. And this is their compassionate way of dealing with it. I don't know. The problem is that it affects us. And even though a lot of these places say that they will never, oh, we would never, you know, take somebody in just because they were sleeping in a rest area. No. The law says they can. And if you give an officer the ability to do something, some of them will use it for other reasons. This is one of my big issues with laws that are not enforced. They're only selectively enforced. It creates an opportunity for legal discrimination, and I think that's a big problem. But it highlights a bigger issue, which is that it's really hard to find out if it's legal to sleep in rest areas anymore. And I'll address that later in the podcast, but it is really hard. You can't just like Google it because you'll get 6 different answers, and there's often no official source. What I found in my research was that everybody was doing this common thing on the internet and in scientific research as well. They were all referencing the same secondary source, meaning this was somebody said somebody did this rather than this is the government of this state, here are the rules, and you can't rely on that. This is actually a Wikipedia problem too. I mean, they're supposed to use primary sources, but not everybody does. It's tough out there. It's really difficult to know if it's legal to sleep somewhere or not, unless it's expressly stated. And I would be in favor of something where every rest area in the country had like a rules board posted or something. But you know, the problem with that is they would all opt to not allow overnight parking in your vehicle. And then, you know, we'd have even fewer options. So I'll link to this article. It just highlights the problem we've been talking about a lot. But it also goes on to list, you know, places where it's illegal to overnight park in rest areas. And the list they come up with is Florida, Georgia, North Carolina, South Carolina, Pennsylvania, and Tennessee. It's actually much, much more complicated than that. North Carolina, according to this, has a 4-hour limit. Tennessee, as we've talked about, makes it a felony, except in some places you get a 3-hour limit. But I don't know what the difference is. Pennsylvania has a 2-hour limit. And then, according to this article, New York makes it illegal to sleep in your car on any public property anywhere, which means you have to sleep on private property, which means you have to get permission. So It's a mess. It's a mess. It has really changed my personal attitude to van life. I was looking at going to New England and taking my rig out there and doing kind of a shakedown and all this. But the truth is that when you consider gas, okay, you could always do that, tolls, and the fact that I can't spend the night in New York or Ohio easily without getting a campground, it makes it such a hassle and such a worry that it's honestly cheaper to fly. And at that point, you've given up on van life, you know? Yeah, I need to get a hotel, whatever. But, I don't know. It frustrates me. It simply frustrates me. To me, a simple rule would be rest area, 10-hour limit, with only 2 consecutive stays allowed. I can see cases where you would be driving to deliver something and then driving back and want to stay in the same rest area for 2 nights. So, okay, I'll grant that. But then you don't want people living in the rest area. That's the point. So create laws that allow people to do what they want to do, but also solve the problem you're trying to solve. You are not trying to solve the problem of people sleeping in the rest area, because the problem the rest area is trying to solve is to not have people driving sleepy on the road. And so these limits confuse me. Some states, it's really bad. For example, Vermont, I have a lot of experience with driving in Vermont. The rest areas are all simply closed at night. You never mind sleeping. You can't even go to them. The rest areas are locked. And in fact, between certain hours in the entire state of Vermont, it is not legal to pee anywhere. There are no legal pee places in the whole state of Vermont, except maybe some diners or something that are open, but you have to find them and they're not obvious and they could be hundreds of miles away. Anyway, I'm always going to rant about this, but I do want to add on to this that there's another article from Jalopnik that I will link to called The Best Spots to Park RV Overnight. And this is their list very quickly. You can read the article, but first thing they say is truck stops. I have mixed opinions of that. I have heard of truck stops kicking van life people out. I've run into that problem at a specific truck stop where I was stuck there during a storm. They were not happy that I wasn't leaving. And I said, I'm sorry, but it's either I stay here or I risk everyone else's lives on the road. And that's an easy choice for me to make. And then you can see the veracity of this article. Jalopnik then says, Walmart, Home Depot, and other businesses. This is a recent article, by the way. This is from August. This isn't something they just came up with. So I can't really trust that Jalopnik is paying attention, because most van lifers know that Walmart pretty much is a no-go zone. I mean, there are some Walmarts where you can do it, but it's not like it used to be. And Home Depot does not have a good record of letting people stay there. Oh, make sure you call the manager, which, you know, we know how that goes. So, yeah. They do recommend Cracker Barrel, which does seem to be one good place. And then gyms that are open 24 hours sometimes allow overnight parking, but I know a lot of Planet Fitness folks have gotten in trouble because they've pulled into Planet Fitness late at night, gone in for a shower, and then found somebody like writing them a ticket or waiting for them to complain that they can't park there overnight. Anyway, Cabela's and Bass Pro Shops, same thing. I have spent many nights in Cabela's and Bass Pro Shops, but what happens is that they're fine with it, maybe. They actually have RV parking spaces at many of them. But the community isn't, so they will pass an ordinance that no business can allow overnight parking there. And how do you tell the difference? These could be town-by-town ordinances. If only we had a directory. Oh, wait, yeah, then we have iOverlander, which creates that problem, which is like, oh, here's a list of places you can stay. Oh, no, 10,000 people showed up tonight. We can't let people stay there anymore. You know. Sigh. It also mentions churches. Yes, some churches will allow this, but that's a very, very case-by-case basis, and you're going to have to try to figure that out on your own. And then they mention Harvest Hosts, which makes me wonder if they're an affiliate. Harvest Hosts, if you've not heard of this, this is a pay subscription model where a bunch of different places will allow you to spend the night. You have to make reservations. And the standing kind of unstated rule is that you will patronize that business. So a lot of these are wineries and farms and breweries, those places that make beer. And you can stay there, and the idea is that you will spend the night, and then you will go inside and like tour the winery or buy some beer or whatever. It does cost money. You got to pay about $80 a year. And then it's awkward. You're not on your own schedule. You know, they might have in and out times, and they're going to be waiting for you to spend money there in the morning. And, well, what are you going to do with a case of wine in your van? Never mind. I don't want it, the answer to that question. There's another one called Boondocker's Welcome that's a similar thing. So they also have limits on the rig. You have to have a fully contained RV. So if you're dripping gray water on the ground, nope, not for you. And if you don't have a bathroom, nope, not for you. And if you need electricity, maybe or maybe not for you. Anyway. And then the article goes on to list useful apps, which, you know, we've talked about. And the point is that Jalopnik posted this article about here's all the places you can't stay. And then they got a lot of feedback saying, well, where can we stay? And the answer is not too many places. You really can't go out now and just figure out where you're going to sleep an hour before you're going to sleep. You have to make plans ahead of time and do research. And the information is not always going to be correct. And it bugs me. And I'm going to stop ranting now. How's that? Product review. I bought this thing that I did not buy it for my rig, but I think it would have a use in some people's rigs, so I thought I'd mention it. So this is the Ciarra, which is spelled C-I-A-R-R-A, Portable Range Hood, which is not really what it is. This is a device that's meant to suck all the smoke and steam and whatever away from your cooking area and then through filters and then exhaust clean air. Most RVs, because they have propane, will also have a vent hood. And you're always supposed to run the vent hood if you're cooking, even if you're not making smoke. It'll say that in the manual. People don't read manuals. But that's what you're supposed to do because that exhaust the gases from the propane cooking. And you might say, but I don't have to do that at home. And the only reason you don't is because you have more airspace. RVs have limited airspace, so they are required to have these to meet RVIA standards. But we're building our own rigs here, and we don't follow those standards at all. We also cook, and we make smoke, and sometimes the ventilation in our rigs isn't good enough. So these things can help. This is a portable thing. But it does need to be plugged in. It uses 110-volt power. You can find battery-powered ones of these. There's a bunch of different ones of these. But it's a big round fan that sucks the smoke up, and it sends it through three filters. There's a Teflon filter on the front that is the easy-to-clean part. And then it goes through an aluminum filter that will capture grease, and that all drips into a container that you can empty. And then there's a charcoal filter that gets rid of the smoke and smells. I bought this for my condo because we don't have any kind of vent hood in the condo. The way our condo's figured, it's in an old warehouse. The cooktop is in the middle of the kitchen where there's like a 10-foot ceiling. There's nowhere to vent outside. No one has a vent hood, which is a big pain in the butt because the smoke detectors go off all the time. So that's why we got this thing. And it does work. If you have like a single frying pan and you're cooking, say, bacon or piece of chicken or whatever, it will suck up enough of the smoke and fumes that the whole place doesn't smell like what you're cooking, and it stops setting off the smoke detector. So for us, in that circumstance, it does work fairly well. However, you have to clean it every single time you use it because it gets filled with grease. It's not that hard, but you do have to clean it. You have to empty that container. And you have to be very careful. If you read the manual, it will tell you that you can't use this with an open flame cooker. So like a propane or butane cooker, you're not supposed to use this with those because they can get too hot. Like it'll suck up so much heat that you'll start to melt the thing. Now, in our case, we're breaking that rule because we don't really have a choice. And so I'm being very careful as to where I place it. You need to put it close to the pan, but not too close. It needs to suck up the smoke, not the heat. It's a little bit of a balancing act. If you have an electric cooktop, then you don't have to worry about that because electric cooktops are much more efficient at the heat going into the food and not just in the air around it. These things range in price from like $60 to $140. The one I got is on the lower end, but it does work. Just remember that this is not helping your air quality much. You're not getting any new oxygen in. It's just filtering the air that's already in there. So this is not a replacement for a full range hood that exhausts outside. But in some rigs, I can imagine this being useful if you're just trying to get the smells of cooking or the smoke under control. You need space to store this thing too. It is about the size of a loaf of bread with another loaf of bread on top of it at a right angle, basically. Think about it like that. And it doesn't come apart. The shape is the shape. You're stuck with that. So I'll have a link in the show notes. this could help somebody, but I think for most folks, this isn't really going to do much, and the amount of space it takes isn't worth it. However, if you're in the situation like I am in the condo, actually, it works pretty well. Tales from the road. A couple years back, I went up to North Dakota because it's a state I hadn't spent a lot of time in. So I thought, you know, I should really just go explore North Dakota a bit. And I was looking for one specific thing called Writing Rock. Now, to be clear, there is a Writing Rock Park in North Dakota, and a writing rock was basically a petroglyph site. It was, you know, a rock that somebody in ancient times had carved things into. Petroglyphs all over the country, and some more recent than others, and sometimes dating them is difficult because people have made them in modern times. And that's not what I'm talking about. I did not go to that park. I went to a very specific rock. This one was very mysterious, because nobody knew when it was made or what language it was in, because it had lines on it, almost like a musical staff, and then dots that, you know, some people interpreted it as musical notes, other people thought it was a representation of a map, or basically nobody knows what this thing is, or who did this, or anything. There have also suggestions that it's just some glacial markings, which is a very common thing. Glacier comes by, drags rocks on cross rocks, leaves marks, and some people see writing in those marks when they're really just rocks scraping against each other. It could be that too. Especially rocks that have then fallen in the river, where the river has added to the erosion of those lines and made them look intentional. At any rate, I wanted to see this thing. And I knew it was right across from Fort Ransom Park Historic Site. We're talking about Fort Ransom, North Dakota. And next to a pond called the Mooring Stone Pond. Now, what's a mooring stone? Well, it's what it sounds like. A mooring stone is a stone that has been carved so that a boat can moor to it. Basically, a big rock with a hole in it. And it's different than an anchor stone because anchor stones are more portable. Mooring stones were less portable. They're almost just a bigger version of the same thing. And someone had found one of these stones in this tiny little pond by this fort. And so that's where it got its name. It's a very deep, small pond. That, well, when I got there, I found the pond, and it looked really man-made to me. It was a very small pond. I mean, you could easily throw a rock across this pond. And it was very deep. And the hills next to it were steep. And it's just like, somebody dammed this and made a pond. Now, it is dammed now. In modern times, a real dam that you could open up has been put in basically for flood control, I think. So, yes, it's man-made now, but it goes back a long ways and it is not considered man-made. In fact, who would put a mooring stone next to such a small pond when this is the kind of pond that I don't even know what you would use a boat for in it so small? Well, the Vikings, of course. See, this whole region of the upper Midwest, during the 19th century, there was this huge wave of belief that the Vikings traveled up there and settled. And I know I've talked about this before. This is where the Minnesota Vikings football team comes from. I mean, back then, there was competition between who discovered America and therefore who owned America, because there was ownership there. So you had Columbus, the Italian sailing from Spain, very Catholic, but then you also had the Vikings coming over before Columbus and from Protestant countries, although they weren't Protestant then, because this is long before Protestantism. But that was the struggle. It was a Protestant versus Catholic thing, and I've seen this over and over and over again in the research of all the different places I'm going. Even in this Aurora's book that I'm writing, one of the Auroras, Aurora, Kansas, is called that Catholic town by all the other towns around it. It was actually hard to research because of that, because they all dismissed it as, oh, you know, that Catholic town. Anyway, because of this belief that the Vikings had been there, find evidence that they were, or, you know, they look for evidence that they were, and people, despite the saying, seeing is believing, the truth is actually believing is seeing. You have to have the idea of something in order to see it and understand what it is. And if you are looking for Viking writing on rocks, yeah, you're going to find marks on rocks and think it's Viking writing. And I don't know if that's the case with this stone or not, because I couldn't find it. And I was frustrated because everything I had read said it's right next to the pond. And I went around the pond, and I actually drove around for a couple hours trying to find a back way to it, and I could never find it. And this was after I talked to the park personnel and asked where the rock was, because in my mind, this is a major feature of this Fort Ransom Park. And one of the guides said they'd never heard of it, and the other one said, oh, I've heard of that. I think it's over by the fort somewhere. This has always baffled me, where people work at a place with something interesting and yet they don't know anything about it. And not because they haven't been trained on it. I would just think curiosity would have led them to, you know, Google it some night or something. But not everybody's wired that way, I guess. I am, and I'm confused by people who aren't, and they're probably confused by people like me who would drive, you know, 700, 800 miles to go find a rock. That's the story. I never found the rock. I had this really nice trip up there. Fort Ransom's a beautiful little town. It's touristy. It's supposed to be. There is a mountain there that is pyramidical. It looks like a pyramid. And a lot of people say that the Vikings built it. In fact, there's a statue of a Viking on top of it, because that couldn't possibly be made by nature, ignoring all the glaciers that came through there. But anyway, but if you ever happen to be in Fort Ransom and can find this rock that some people say is on private property, which I don't understand because the pond is in the park, I would love a picture of it. I would love your impression of what you found, because it's a really interesting looking rock from the pictures, but all the pictures have been modified. People have drawn lines where they may not really be. If you do go find this rock, bring a bucket or bring some water, because that's the best way to see these old quote-unquote carvings. You pour water on them, you're not going to do any damage to it, but it will highlight the contrast between the carving part and the flat part. A place to visit. Well, winter is upon us. We had a lovely bit of snow here in the Chicago area, and I like it. A lot of people hate the snow, but I'm always happy to see the snow, even in winter. And my truck, I'm happy to report, was great in the snow. I made a long journey. Well, I didn't that long. I drove up to Wisconsin, which isn't that big of a deal from here, in the snowstorm, on unplowed streets. I had no problems at all with the truck. Pickup trucks are often bad in the snow because rear-wheel drive with a vehicle that has a lot of torque and nothing in the bed means they fishtail all over the place, but I've got that big cap in the bed, so I had the weight, and my tires were decent, and I didn't have to put it in four-wheel drive once. It was nice knowing it was there, though, in case I got stuck. But it got me thinking that with this new anxiety about finding places to sleep at night, and the added complication of snow, which means there's fewer spaces because people are filling empty space with snowbanks and such, wouldn't it be prudent to stay at a campground when you're doing winter camping? So I looked at that, like, well, how realistic is that? I mean, okay, sure, you can find winter camping in Georgia because their winter is pretty wimpy. Sorry, Georgians, I know those ice storms are hard on you, but Maine's got a different scenario. And there is not a really easy list, but I did find one that's fairly reliable, and it's KOA. You know, KOA, the most commercial of all campgrounds, they have a list of sites that are open specifically in the winter, and I have added that into the show notes. You can just go to KOA.com and search for KOA campgrounds that are open all year. That's the wording, not winter, all year. And they will list them by state. Problem is, and it's not really, I mean, it's the problem that we started with, not every state has KOA campgrounds that are open in the winter. I found some in most states, but New England was particularly hard. There's some in Connecticut, and by some, I mean one, and there's one in Maine. But Massachusetts, Vermont, New Hampshire, Rhode Island, nothing. And I am specifically focused on New England these days, and this doesn't help. Camping in New England is hard, especially for van life, and in the winter, it's no easier. But I thought I would pass this resource on to you because it is at least a resource, and if you're looking to do some winter camping and you at least want one or two nights in an established campground where you can charge your batteries and get fresh water and all that, this is a list that is reliable. I know there's other lists out there, but this one is 100% reliable. You can make reservations on the site. You can call the places. If they say they're open, they will be open. Resource. Recommendation. Okay, now, the bit that I spent most of the time on for this episode. Here's the question. Can you sleep in your car in a rest area? I talk about this a lot. I've talked about it a lot just in this episode. And I found a guide that is the best guide I have ever seen on this topic. There's lots of like blogs out there that say these states allow it, these states don't, and all that. And that information is almost instantly out of date because all these states are changing their rules. Or if it's not out of date, it's incomplete because some states it's rest area by rest area. Oh, that one's fine for overnight. No, that one's only half an hour. No, that one, no. And there may not be signs. It's this unwritten rule that you're just going to have to find out. This is not a slam dunk resource for figuring it out, but it is the best resource I've found. And weirdly, to me, it is from EcoFlow. EcoFlow, the company that makes batteries and little air conditioners, I guess they think it's wise to post van life articles and then that will lead people into buying their products, which they're not wrong. And indeed, at the very bottom of this considerable article, they're like, what about power? Did you know that EcoFlow makes power banks? You know, which is fine. I'm not complaining about that. I just think it's funny. Most of those articles are just AI garbage, you know? They're like, AI, write me an article about sleeping in the winter at night. And then they copy and paste it and put their ad at the bottom. This is actually a very, very good article. And it explains a lot of things that people have questions about. For example, what is the difference between camping and sleeping in your vehicle at night? They explain that, and this is what I have always interpreted that to mean, is that camping is sleeping outside your vehicle, setting up a tent, setting up anything outside, or cooking outside even. That's camping. Sleeping inside your vehicle is literally that. You are sleeping inside your vehicle. And this article agrees with me. That's why I like it. But then they talk about the difference between picnic areas and full-service plazas. You know, what is the proper way to use these places? For example, trash. Should you take your 30-gallon trash bag and dump it into a trash can at a rest area? Is that even legal? I mean, actually, it's hard to say. Some places say no household trash, and my interpretation of that is that it would not be legal to do that. My personal policy for that kind of thing is that I limit myself to never disposing of more than a single grocery bag size amount of trash at any one place, which is kind of a lot of trash, but I feel like that doesn't push the limit too far. So every time I get gas, I throw away whatever trash I have. And by keeping up that way, it's hardly ever more than a bag that size. I'm never going to take one of those giant green hefty bags and kind of stuff it in there, which people do. They absolutely do that. So that's an etiquette thing. These days, unlike the old days, camping, literally setting up a tent and camping on the lawn of a rest area, is almost universally prohibited. So I would not even consider that. Unless you're going to go full camping with Steve and sleep underneath the propane tank in the back of the rest area behind a collection of empty pet food cans or something, that is out. Also, a couple other things, do not have fires. Forget that. Don't do anything outside your van, basically. That would be the rule. That's my rule, and I think that's the sensible rule. And then don't drink alcohol in the rest area. You can get into all kinds of trouble there. And if a cop wants to give you trouble, holy cow, drinking alcohol in a rest area, whether inside your vehicle or outside your vehicle, is a big problem. So I would treat those as no alcohol or any other substance areas. And then, of course, you are not going to sell goods or anything like that. Don't busk at rest areas. That's not a good place for that. The part I really like is they have a big table of state by state by state by state what you can do. And it's actually detailed and nuanced, which I've never seen any other site do. For example, Georgia. Is overnight parking permitted? And it says, yes, in rest areas only. Okay, that's good to know. Official maximum stay limit, no official limit at rest areas, which is good. Although, if you try to move in there and stay there a week, you may get some attention. And then in the notes, it says, overnight parking is prohibited at visitor information centers, which are not open 24/7. So what is the difference between a rest area and a visitor information center? And I have learned this over the years. The rest area that you see as soon as you cross the border is a visitor information center, and they often have separate rules because they get crowded and they can fill up. You would want to stay at a standard rest area, which would be something down the road. So if you're thinking, oh, geez, I'm in Florida, I want to get out of here, I need a place to stay, I think I'll stay in Georgia, plan to drive maybe 45 miles past the border and stay at that rest area, not the one that's right over the border. The ones right over the border are going to have the most police activity anyway, which you might think is good for a security standpoint, but it's bad if you don't want hassles. One of the ones that's funny on here is Hawaii. Is overnight parking permitted in rest areas of Hawaii? And the answer is not applicable because Hawaii does not have rest areas. They don't have any highway rest areas. And if you think about it, that kind of makes sense. Again, this isn't perfect. Stuff changes. But this is the best resource I have seen on this topic. And I'll have a link at the show notes. It's ecoflow.com and then, well, big long URL. But if you want to search, it's Guide to Overnight Parking at Rest Areas is the name of the article. Good stuff, and I hope EcoFlow keeps making actual quality articles because that's the best way to drive business. People will detect the AI garbage and shun you. And one last thing. This is a little strange. Someone contacted me on Facebook Messenger and introduced me to a song about van life, and due to some Facebook glitch, I could not reply to them or talk to them at all. I believe their name was Greg, and Greg, I'm sorry. I don't know what the problem is. If you want to get a hold of me, send me an email. But Greg said that he found the perfect van life song, and so I'm going to link to that in the show notes because I can't play it on the podcast without getting in trouble. But it's a song by Willie Carlisle, and it's called, well, Van Life. Official. And I think many of you who've spent hours on the road will find it kind of humorous. Well, folks, thank you very much for listening to episode 282. Music, as always, is by Simon Wagg, who has had a bit of a tragedy. The apartment next to his burned down, and his is unlivable right now, and he does not have a van. So any thoughts you'd like to send out into the universe for Simon would be welcome. But he's okay. He's found a place to stay, and everything's getting fixed up. Until next time, remember the words of Norman MacLean, who said, "This is a good way to live and die, maybe the ideal way for any of us. Excitedly finding we were wrong, and excitedly waiting for tomorrow to come so we can start over."